Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Everyday Heroes, we look at the lesser-known people who have shaped history. Then, all over the world, people are joining together in efforts to find new ownership models that can sustain people and communities. New generative models for housing, employment, and credit aim to sustain life for generations to come. Finally, are some green solutions unhelpful for the environment, or worse, do they actually harm it? We know the role of presidents and other leaders in shaping history, but we hear little about the unsung heroes, many who have risked their lives to liberate and rescue others. Who might some of those secret heroes be? We're joined by Paul Martin, journalist, editor, and author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Welcome, Paul Martin. Often thousands are forgotten for the good they've done in making societies better, and you pulled a few out and wrote about them in your book.
That's right. I've always had a lifelong fascination with unsung heroes. I've kept a file for years on these characters when I come across them in my reading or see something on television. When I decided to do a book, I tried to pull out 30 of the most interesting, offering a really broad range of time periods and backgrounds, occupations, and so forth. And the mix that I have is just filled with people that ought to be better known. I mean, there's Hercules Mulligan, who is a tailor in New York City during the Revolutionary War, and he was recruited as a spy. And on two occasions, since he had British officers as customers, he learned about plots to waylay General Washington and was able to warn him and very possibly save his life.
Wasn't his brother also involved?
Was also involved. In fact, his brother was a conduit for another outstanding thing that Mulligan did, and that is he literally converted Alexander Hamilton to the American cause. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean, and he had grown up. He was a loyal British subject. And when he came to study in New York, he went to King's College, which is today's Columbia University, and he needed a place to stay, and he contacted Hercules Mulligan's brother, who referred him on to Hercules, and Alexander Hamilton stayed with Mulligan, and through the course of evening's conversations with Mulligan and his friends, Hamilton was won over to the American cause and became, you know, a real leader.
One of the characters that I thought was most interesting and that I hadn't known as much about as I would have liked to was Mary Elizabeth Bowser, who played a huge role in the Civil War. Tell us about her and her impact on the Civil War.
She was born a slave in Richmond, Virginia. Her master was a hardware merchant in Richmond, and he actually sold off Bowser's family, her mother and father and brother and sister. His name was John Van Loo, and when he died, his daughter, Elizabeth Van Loo, bought back Bowser's family and gave them all their freedom. And Elizabeth Van Loo sent Mary Bowser to Philadelphia to be educated. Bowser came back to Richmond just as the Civil War was starting, and when the Civil War began, Elizabeth Van Loo formed a spy ring for the Union. She recruited Mary Bowser because she was a rarity. She was a former slave, an African-American who was educated, could read and write, which was obviously a rarity at that time. And Van Loo was able to place her in the White House of the Confederacy, the home of Jefferson Davis and his wife and children. Bowser was a family servant, and she took care of Jefferson Davis's children and served meals, cleaned up afterwards. Well, as far as Davis knew, she was an illiterate slave, and he and his officers spoke openly in front of her. She also had a photographic memory, and Davis would leave his papers strewn around on his desk, and she could just, at a glance, pick up all sorts of information about Southern troop movements and finances and so forth. She relayed those on to the Union. She was recognized in 1995 as one of the most important spies for the Union cause during the Civil War.
How was she able to convey that information?
There were some fascinating ways. They would hide messages in like a basket full of eggs. They would hollow out one of the eggs and put messages inside the egg. And another way was they would put it in the shoes of a slave, and the Southerners were disdainful and wouldn't, you know, want to have anything to do with the slaves and their clothing, and so they were able to get things past the Southern soldiers. So it was an amazing display of bravery for 2 years to be by herself, right, as I said, in the lion's den. It turned out that she discovered so many secrets that they began to suspect that there was a mole somewhere in the White House of the Confederacy, and so she fled. She was there for 2 years, and her last act was she tried to burn down the White House of the Confederacy. She wasn't successful, but she fled in 1864 and was never heard of again. She disappeared from history.
There were three other women that I thought were particularly interesting in your book. Anne Royal was one, Grace Abbott, and Inez Boisevain.
Yes, all three of those I'd never heard of. And in fact, I could say I think all but one or two of the characters in my book I'd never heard of, and I wasn't familiar with even the ones that I had heard of. For instance, Hedy Lamarr, I didn't know that the achievements she did that were totally unknown to the public. But the three persons that you mentioned, Anne Royal was just this fabulous character. She was born on the frontier and survived Indian attacks, and she ended up marrying an older man who was quite wealthy. And when he died, she traveled around a bit, and she was well-to-do, but then her husband's family overturned the will, and she was left absolutely penniless at the age of 54. So she decided she'd become a writer, and she started writing travel books, and she wrote one novel. She would live hand-to-mouth the whole time, and then she went to Washington, D.C., and when she was in her 60s, she began a newspaper, and she was a terror. She was the first muckraker in American journalism, and she would traipse around the halls of Congress and government offices and just buttonhole officials and grill them. She would print everything, you know, she found, and she had very strong opinions. She was adamantly for the separation of church and state, and she was just a holy terror.
I think you mentioned that people still study her in journalism schools.
They do. She's regarded as the first of the muckrakers. She's really the first investigative journalist in early history of journalism. Journalism often was advertising or PR almost, and she really dug for the truth and was fearless. And she made so many enemies that the U.S. Post Office stopped delivering her newspaper because she made so many enemies on Capitol Hill. So she started a second newspaper and delivered it on her own. And of course, she never had a very wide circulation or never made any money. In fact, she died, I think she had a total of 6 cents when she died, but her influence was tremendous.
And then the other two really interesting women, Grace Abbott and Inez Boisevain, had to have a little bit more of a similar impact.
Grace Abbott is just someone that you'd never hear of, and the woman was absolutely amazing. She grew up in Nebraska and was trained as a teacher, and she went to Chicago and studied at the University of Chicago, and then she became involved in protecting immigrants. And for 9 years, she ran the Immigrant Protective League, and then she was recruited to the U.S. Children's Bureau, which at that time was a federal office to overlook the rights of the interests of children. And she improved the lives of millions of people through information she distributed on maternal health care and infant health care. Even then, and still today, the infant mortality rate in this country is really shocking. We have 4 times the infant mortality rate of Japan today. And she did so much to protect the children. The other thing she did was she was instrumental in writing the child labor provisions of the Social Security Act. And she also wrote child labor provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Unbelievably, there was still exploitative child labor up to 1938. But afterwards, when that law was passed, we finally ended that shameful period of our history. The other person you mentioned, Inez Boisevain, she was a colorful character. She was one of the few characters in the book who grew up in a wealthy family. And she had a privileged upbringing. She went to Vassar College, but she was a real rebel, and she was in the forefront of the women's suffrage movement, and she made speeches on campus, and as I said in the book, I think the people at Vassar probably threw themselves a party when she finally graduated. But she went on to New York, and she got a law degree at New York University, and one of the first things she did was investigate the horrible prison conditions at Sing Sing. And she wrote a report, and it resulted in widespread reforms. And she literally gave her life for the cause. She was speaking in the western half of the United States, trying to get a passage of universal women's suffrage, and she collapsed on stage in Los Angeles, and it turned out she had pernicious anemia, which today is very treatable, but back then it wasn't, and she ended up dying, and so she was a martyr to her cause.
And only 30 years old.
Exactly. And they told her if she cut back and, you know, stopped exerting herself, she could probably weather this health issue. But she refused to. She literally gave her life for the cause.
And then if we were to move up in time, there are two other people. They're very different. One was Golden Rule Jones, who was very interesting. And the other was Kirk Bloodsworth.
Golden Rule Jones, of course, was a progressive leader during the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. He grew up poor, and he got into the oil business, and he started his own company and made a fortune. He moved to Ohio and started Ohio Oil, which was bought out by Standard Oil, and so he became quite wealthy. But he had a tragedy in his life. His wife and one of his children passed away. He remarried, and his second wife lived in Toledo. So he moved to Toledo, and he started a company to produce oil drilling equipment. It had the memorable name of the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And he was 50 years ahead of his time. He instituted an 8-hour workday. He refused to use child labor. I mean, this was all before, while these things were going on, he was doing these things on his own. He gave Christmas bonuses, paid vacations. He built a park and playground for his employees. And his whole point of view was that everyone should live by the golden rule. I mean, it was very simple, and that's the way he treated his employees, and they responded with incredible loyalty. Well, he became famous for this, and they started around Toledo, started calling him Golden Rule Jones, and then he was put up for election by the Republicans and for mayor of Toledo, and he won. And the amazing thing was that when he started introducing the same kinds of reforms that he'd done in his company to city government, the Republicans were up in arms, business interests. They thought, you know, that this was not the way to go. So the next election for mayor, they kicked him to the side, and he ran as an independent, and he won with 70% of the vote, and he was reelected three other times. He died in office when he was 54, but he was a real progressive, and he was one of the people who brought us things that we accept today. Everyone thinks that a 40-hour work week and paid vacations are the right of all Americans, but if it wasn't for people like Samuel Jones, that just wouldn't have happened. The other person you mentioned, Kirk Bloodsworth, he's interesting for several reasons. One, he's the only living character of the 30 people I write about. He's still alive. He grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. His family was, they were watermen. He grew up crabbing and oystering, helping his dad on his boat. And he joined the Marines, and after the Marines, he married a woman who lived in Essex, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And at the very time that he settled in Essex, a 9-year-old girl was brutally raped and murdered, and Kirk Bloodsworth was arrested for this. He had nothing to do with it. He was completely innocent. And he was convicted basically on the testimony of a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old who said they saw him. Well, he spent 9 years in prison. He was convicted and given the death sentence, and he was sent to prison in Baltimore, the state prison penitentiary. His death sentence was overturned. He was given 2 life terms. And to while away the time, I mean, to keep himself sane, he would read a lot in the prison library, and he happened to read a book about DNA profiling, which was perfected in 1984 by a professor in Leicester, England. And a light bulb went on, and Bloodsworth said, well, this could be used to prove I was not the killer. And it just happened that his attorney had asked that all the evidence in the case be saved, and it was sent to a lab in California and tested, and he was exonerated and set free after 9 years in prison. He was the first death row inmate to be set free by DNA testing in this country.
And then he went on and made it part of his cause.
He did. He was instrumental in getting the Innocence Protection Act and the testing portion of that act, which any convicted prisoner is tested for DNA now. Their DNA is recorded, and that test is named in Bloodsworth's honor.
Well, Paul Martin, thank you so much, and thank you for honoring the everyday Americans who shape our world. The book, again, is called Secret Heroes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
Stay tuned. Thank you. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Sometimes disasters bring something new and better, says our next guest, and that could very well be the situation with our economic system. In fact, all over the world, people are joining together in efforts to find new ownership models that can sustain people and communities. New generative models for housing, employment, and credit aim to sustain life for generations to come. The book, Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution, says they are forming a movement that may not yet know it's a movement. With us now is Marjorie Kelly. She is a fellow at the TELUS Institute think tank and the author of The Divine Right of Capital and her latest book, Owning Our Future. She was also the founder of Business Ethics Magazine. Well, welcome back, Marjorie Kelly.
It's fun to be here. Thanks for having me,
it's
Maria.
It's great to have you back on the air with us with your brand new book. What I'd like to start with is really this idea that crisis often can bring something unexpectedly good, and that the economic crisis may actually allow for some kind of transformation. So let's start with this idea. What gives you hope that this may occur? That you actually gave an example of an organization in Great Britain that occurred from the ashes like that?
You know, Maria, I look even at a very simple level. We have a couple of trees that we lost in our yard a few years back. We mourned these trees. We thought, what can we replace these with? And then there was a small magnolia tree beneath one of them that just shot up and filled out that space. And I realized it hadn't had room to grow yet. And this is something that happens ecologically. When you have what looks like a crisis, it can kind of clear the way for new species to shoot up. And I think that's what we can see. You know, as we're seeing the big banks in crisis, I think we can start to see alternative kinds of ownership having their day.
And this one example that you wrote about in the book, it was in a different section, but about a giant employee-owned company that started because people couldn't afford to eat. What was this company and what happened?
That's a really fascinating example. This is the Rochdale Pioneers. It was back in the 1800s, and it was when the Industrial Revolution was just beginning. And there were craftsmen who were pushed out of their jobs and couldn't afford to eat. And so they formed the world's very first cooperative. It was a store. They were selling food to people who couldn't afford to buy it. You became a member and you could buy food at the store. And it was the world's first cooperative. And that is now a model that has spread to most nations. There are millions of members of cooperatives all over the world. In fact, cooperatives now employ more people than all multinationals combined. This is not very widely known.
You mean globally?
I mean globally, that's right. And just in brief, a cooperative is a business that is owned and controlled democratically by the people it serves. It could be employees, it could be customers, it's in a credit union. You know, there's a number of different forms.
We have, on this show, talked quite a bit with the people of Mondragon. Mm-hmm. And about that model spreading around. But aside from Mondragon, we don't know very many.
You know, there are a surprising number. You know, in fact, cooperative banks are very common in Europe. They're Rabobank in the Netherlands. It's the largest bank, I believe, in the entire country. And across Europe, cooperative banks control 21% of all deposits. And so this is one of the things that I talk about in the book, is that as widespread and large as these alternative ownership models are, they remain largely invisible. And I think it's because we haven't named them yet. And so I try to name them in the book. I say it's really the generative economy. These are designs that are not aimed at creating maximum amounts of short-term capital. They're aimed at creating the conditions for life. They want to generate the conditions for life.
Well, that leads us right to the kind of crux of your argument. One is really about ownership being at the root of economic systems. But the second one is that you identify two different kinds of ownership models, one that is more generative and one that is what you call extractive. Mm-hmm. Why don't we first talk about the extractive model? Because it's kind of the one that you identify as the problem.
Yeah, that's right. I think that many of us, unconsciously, we think of ownership as a fact. You own something or you don't. But really, it's a design. It has a design. And the design that we know most pervasively is corporations. So they have a particular ownership design where their ownership shares trade in public stock markets. And the purpose of these companies in this kind of ownership is to extract as much financial wealth as possible. So we believe that stock portfolios should go up every quarter and that shareholders should have the right to maximize their returns. This is, it's really an industrial age model. And it's pervasive. I mean, it really is the largest, most pervasive model in the world. And then when I say, but, you know, there's another way to own things, and that's generative. It's where you're owning things with the purpose of serving life, serving the community. And I point, for example, to a large employee-owned firm in the UK that has, it's, you know, the largest department store chain in the UK. It's the John Lewis Partnership. It's 100% owned by its employees. And its purpose, they state publicly, is to serve employee happiness. And it's an example of a company that's large and successful and out there operating like a regular business, and it has a different purpose. It's not about extracting wealth for shareholders. It's about making employees happy.
And this extractive model, of course, can be taken to seen in terms of other things that are extracted as well, like natural resources as opposed to generative serving.
Right. Yeah, and so the point that I'm trying to make is that there's really two kinds of extraction in this industrial age economy. There's physical extraction, which we know so well. You know, you're extracting fossil fuels from the earth. You're extracting, you know, all kinds of physical elements from the earth. But then there's also this financial extraction, which is really where the action is. You know, if we talk about ecological damage, that's really kind of an effect of the system's action, but its real purpose is the extraction of financial wealth. And that's what we need to start talking about.
So let's talk about what some of the design problems are in this, like the extraction model. You point to one issue, which is what its purpose is, right? And that's part of the design of it. This is something that people don't talk about very much when they look at a societal or a political problem. They don't look at the system design and the design flaws, thinking that people function as a result of the design. Let's look at these design flaws, one of them being the mission or the purpose.
You know, it's interesting, Maria, because I think a lot of people think, you know, CEOs are the problem. And if we just had a better crop of CEOs, everything would be different. We're not used to thinking about the fact that organization design shapes behavior, that these CEOs are hired by boards to do a particular thing, which is to maximize returns for shareholders. They're paid accordingly. And if they don't do it, they're fired. And so it's a system that's really controlling them rather than vice versa, even though they look like they're at the helm. And so what is really driving these organizations? Well, it's the purpose at their core. You know, if you look at systems thinking, which is a kind of thinking that applies to biological systems and social systems also, you know, it says that what really shapes human communities, human social systems, is values. You know, there are values at the core of particular social architectures. I mean, the court system is a social architecture, and at its core is the value of justice. And, you know, democracy is a social architecture, and at its core is equality and liberty and all the things that democracy stands for. Well, at the core of the social architectures that we have in our economy, these extractive designs, there's this purpose of maximizing financial wealth, and it's for individuals, and not for the community as a whole. So these are really the values at the core of it. And what I'm seeing in the book is that you can have other values that are also embedded in social architectures. I mean, John Lewis Partnership is a key example. You know, they have employee well-being as a key value at the center of it, or cooperatives, which have a value of, you know, the common good at the center of it. And you can really design ownership architectures, economic architectures, around these values, and it works.
One of the things that you note is that in this particular system's ownership and this design and the mess that they've made, that we're really kind of all tangled up in it. How would you express this entanglement?
No, that's a really key point, Maria. I mean, it's not really about pointing the fingers at bad people somewhere, that they're the problem. it's really about this system design that we're tangled up in. Many of us have stock in our retirement portfolios, and we want to see it do well. Or we work for nonprofits that rely on grant income that comes from financial portfolios. Or maybe we are involved in a foundation, or we support foundations or nonprofits that...
And public that employee systems as well.
Yeah, our pensions, right, our pensions and churches. You know, we all are reliant on returns from wealth and donations from wealth. And so it's not an easy thing to step away from it or to just say, you know, let's get rid of this and start something else. You have to really, I think, look for the alternative models that are working in the system as it is and look at how to grow those. So that's a lot what I'm looking at here.
Well, let's take a look at what these alternative models could look like and what some of them are that are emerging. There was a quote you had in your book that even called it, I thought this was great, a movement that doesn't know it's a movement. And that's in part because they're really emerging in disparate places in the world and not necessarily connected with one another. There are several areas that it seems to be working. One is in housing. How do you see the housing model and the ownership model of housing potentially evolving?
You know, that's an interesting story because it was in December 2008 when the stock market was in the middle of this huge crash. It was going down by about 43% in that year. And right in the middle of that, I took a bus to the Community Land Trust Conference here in Boston. And community land trusts are ownership designs where the community will own the land beneath a group of homes through a nonprofit. And then the individual families own their own homes privately. And this model, it reduces the price of homes because it's just the price of a house, not the land, and it stabilizes it. And what I found at that moment when the economy was falling apart was that community land trust homes had a foreclosure rate one-tenth that of traditional homes. And so you didn't see these shenanigans, you didn't see these spikes in prices and then this big collapse in price. You saw a very stable, affordable price. You saw people get to stay in their homes. And that was a result of ownership model and ownership design. I mean, these homes had mortgages, but they were in a different ownership design that was aimed at their well-being. It was not aimed at enriching some banker.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. We've been speaking with Marjorie Kelly about her book called Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution. You focus a lot on the issue of ownership in this particular book. Why is it you settled on ownership specifically?
Well, you know, Maria, you were part of an initiative that we did, which is called Corporation 2020, where for a number of years here at Telus Institute, we brought together leaders and thinkers from business and labor, civil society, finance, government, law, and we explored this question of how would you design companies differently. And I remember one moment, there's a lot of wandering around and seemingly impenetrable kind of concepts. You know, and there was one moment, somebody said something that just stopped the whole group. They said, ownership is the original system condition. It's only when things are owned that wealth is created. It is the system condition that allows everything else to happen. When I saw that, I realized that really is true. I mean, ownership is, when you go back really to the agricultural age, back past the industrial age, you see that when we emerged from hunter-gatherer societies and began to take up the settled life of agriculture, that was a physical technology, but you also needed a social technology that allowed that to happen, a social architecture, and that was ownership. I mean, if you don't own the land, you can't farm it if you're going to be pushed off that land. In fact, in many developing countries today, they don't have stable ownership, but they don't have good land records or not clear title to land, and so people can't develop that land. They can't start businesses if there isn't clear title or clear ownership. So ownership is really what is the original condition that allows wealth to happen. And it's the foundation of our economy. You know, we don't we don't recognize that, but it is the key condition, the foundation that shapes.
And so what you're arguing now is that it's an ownership problem that is creating the economic crisis, and there's not a shared ownership that is, shall we say, contributing to the things that we really care about, community, mm-hmm. neighborhoods, environments.
I think we need to start from the premise that we can't keep tinkering at the edges of the economy that we have. I mean, we have operated since, you know, for many decades with the premise that the economy is pretty much run by corporations, and then we're just going to regulate them. That's the basic frame that we're in. And if you see that this is beginning to break down, that this is less and less effective, then you need to begin to move toward an economy that is designed differently. It's designed so that accountability is built in. You know, there's a large question about how do you get there, and you can't really start there. You have to start with, well, what is it? I mean, can we even begin to imagine a different kind of economy? I think many people cannot. We just think the economy is what it is. It will always be this way. And so to begin to develop a vision of a different, fundamentally different kind of economy where beneficial outcomes are part of its design, that's the vision that I'm looking for in the journeys of this book and that I'm finding all over the world.
Well, you identified five, actually, core elements, what you call them, of a generative ownership design.
It really starts with purpose. What is the purpose of an entity? Does it have a financial purpose of just maximum financial wealth, or does it have a living purpose? Are we trying to help people stay in their homes? Are we trying to, you know, create jobs and so forth? So living purpose, that is really the first element of generative ownership design. Then next comes membership. It's what we traditionally call ownership. I call it membership to distinguish it. But, you know, who is the firm? When you draw a circle and say these people are inside the organization, you know, they have a seat on the board, or, you know, they own it. Who are those people? In a cooperative, you can create employee ownership. You draw the circle around employees. In a credit union, you can create a depositor ownership. So you can draw that ownership circle differently. So that with a generative design, you have ownership in human hands. That's a characteristic. Third is governance. Who runs it? Who has a vote for the seat on the board? How do they get there? You can have governance on autopilot, or you can have governance in the hands of mission. So people oriented toward mission, are they the ones who are in control of the organization? So that's third. And then fourth, you have capital. How do you get finance? How do you get capital into these organizations? Do you have, you know, casino finance, which we have now, where shares can trade hands literally tens of thousands of times in a second? Or do you have, you know, it's finance a friend? So you have stakeholder finance. That's another element of generative ownership design. And then the fifth one is networks. Right now, companies will trade in commodity networks. Well, basically, they'll buy and sell anything if it makes a profit. But generative ownership is about ethical networks that support ethical values. It might be fair trade. It might be organic food. It might be social investing. There's various networks that support ethical values in business.
Okay. And so if you had, say, a bunch of firms that adhered to this, how do we turn that into an economy?
You know, that's a big question, and I think that it's a question that is really as large as the question of global warming. It's about transitioning to a fundamentally different kind of economy. So it's not going to have a simple or a single answer. I mean, you know, with global warming, there are theorists who hypothesize that you need what they call seven wedges. You know, if you're going to reduce carbon use by this dramatic amount, you're going to do it with different wedges of activity. One might be, you know, wind power. Another one might be solar power and so forth. Another one might be, you know, saving energy. So, you know, what are the different wedges that can get us to a different kind of economy? Well, you know, this hasn't been totally worked out. It's not like, you know, one person can step forward with some magic blueprint and make it all happen. But I'll give just a couple of examples. I mean, I think that first of all, we start with what economists call the rule of 15. That the economy is, you know, if you see GDP rising a couple of percent from year to year, it looks fairly stable, but underneath that there's tremendous churn. 15% of every jobs are being destroyed every year, and 15% are being created. So there's this tremendous churn of both jobs and of companies. And if we could get emerging companies into generative designs, into employee ownership, or cooperative, or, you know, social enterprise, that then you begin to see a very different economy. Maybe you get 10% within 10 years. Maybe in 20 years it's 20%, and so on. So there's kind of an emergent, I think, quality to this. That's one. That could be one wedge. I think another wedge could be, let's look at crisis and the opportunities that offers. For example, when General Motors almost went bankrupt a number of years ago, it suddenly was held by government. Government had to take over General Motors. Well, that was an opportunity. We could have rechartered that firm. We could have said, okay, you are moving forward with a new charter, with the common good is at your core. You're no longer going to be a profit-maximizing company. We could have done the same thing with the big banks. So you can look to crisis. Those are just two examples, I think, of the kind of disparate effort that together can start to build a new kind of generative economy.
I know you have engaged a lot of leaders from the labor union community.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of reactions are you getting from them about changing their model?
Right. You know, Maria, there's actually a really interesting movement happening right now for union cooperatives. And so this is a model that the Teamsters are working for. Mondragon, which is a large cooperative business in Spain, is working for this. And it's the idea that unions themselves would help to create worker-owned businesses and also have unions within them. So the workers can be owners, and yet you would also have collective bargaining. Because just because employees have a few shares doesn't mean they're necessarily in a position to bargain effectively for wages. So there's actually a pretty big movement about that lets these things can work together. So I don't think there's any lack of compatibility between the different approaches.
I wanted to check with you on Latin America. You mentioned it. You mentioned something that you saw there emerging that you called a solidarity economy.
Yeah.
How big is it comparatively to, say, big corporate economies?
You know, that's a key question that I don't think anyone has answered yet. I think it's a very big research question that I'd love to see someone take on. The solidarity economy is a concept that it's in Latin America. It's also in Quebec. It encompasses, in Quebec, it's cooperatives and nonprofits. In Latin America, it's used to refer to a lot of worker-owned businesses as well. So it's the idea that, you know, we're in this together. We're in solidarity. And I think it's emerging. I think it's growing. But I haven't seen anybody who's yet quantified it.
Finally, we have listeners all over the country. Some of them are out of work, wondering what they can do next. How would you advise them?
People will often say, what can we do to help advance, you know, the ownership revolution, the generative economy? I think there are a number of things we can do. I think the one thing we can do is read. We need to educate ourselves. When we lack economic literacy, we become sitting ducks for other people to take advantage of us. And so I think reading about the new economy, you know, reading my book, Owning Our Future, reading other books about progressive economics and these things, this is so vital. I cannot say how vital this is, because we don't have enough knowledge about finance and economics among ordinary people, and we need to. So that's one thing. Another thing is that all of us have bank accounts. And so, I mean, no matter how broke we are, most of us have a bank account. You know, we ought to move our money to cooperative banks and credit unions and locally owned community banks. And I think this is noticed by the big banks.
There was a movement on that for a bit.
Yeah, it's called Move Your Money.
Right.
And I think there's still a website devoted to that. I think that's tremendously powerful. And I think that, you know, perhaps we need to be forming new economy groups, because I think the other thing, I think the final thing I would say is this is not something we can solve alone. You know, we can't just go home and buy organic products or, you know, that it's not a consumer revolution. It's about moving toward a fundamentally different kind of economy, and we need to do that collectively.
So essentially what you're saying is gather up your friends and have this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so we ought to form new economy groups. I mean, we need to find ways to act collectively to advance our knowledge and our action. We are not cohering yet as a new economy movement, and we need to.
Marjorie Kelly, the new book is called Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution, Journeys to a Generative Economy. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, Heather Rogers on green solutions. Are they helpful or harmful? Stay tuned.
In December 1962, Pacifica Radio recorded Rachel Carson speaking before the National Women's Press Club. Rachel Carson described some of the unsavory alliances between pesticide manufacturers and supposedly objective scientists.
Just an example or two gleaned at random from the Journal of Economic Entomology. A paper from the University of Wisconsin carries the note, this research was also supported in part by grants from the Shell Chemical Company, Velsicol Chemical Corporation, and Wisconsin Canners Association. Another paper from the Illinois Natural History Survey declares this investigation was sponsored by the Monsanto Chemical Company of St. Louis, Missouri. Research supported by the pesticide manufacturers is not likely to be directed at discovering facts unfavorable to the continuance of current practices. Such a liaison between science and industry is a growing phenomenon, but seen in other areas as well. For example, the American Medical Association, through its newspaper, has just referred physicians to a pesticide trade association for information to help them answer patients' questions about the effects of pesticides on man.
Ecologist, scientist, and author Rachel Carson from Pacifica Radio Archives Environment Series.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Over the past few years, more and more green solutions have emerged to address environmental crises. But our next guest says that some of these amount to lazy environmentalism and may have a dark side effect of camouflaging a larger problem. Heather Rogers argues that our current socioeconomic system depends on pollution to maintain its own well-being. And if so, what are the real solutions? Heather Rogers joins us now. She's a journalist and author of Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Welcome.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to actually start with this concept of lazy environmentalism.
Sure.
And what you mean by it.
Right. It's not a term that I coined. It's something that has some currency in the newer generation of environmentalism, which eschews the guilt, you know, and the sacrifice of, you know, the environmentalism that came up in the 1970s. It's the 40th anniversary of Earth Day. Saying, okay, we don't have to suffer. We can live in nice houses and we can live well and we can drive where we want to drive in hybrid cars and enjoy ourselves. And we can use the market mechanisms in order to have a good life and save the planet. And I don't know if that really works.
So you actually argue that you don't think it does at all and might even make it worse in some ways.
Well, what happens is the way that the market works is that it has to grow. And in order to do that, it has to utilize materials in nature. It can't stop extracting and affecting the natural environment, ecosystems that we need in order to hold back climate change, in order to keep our water clean and diverse species all over the planet. What I'm saying is that, you know, there's this fundamental logic that we can't undo by replacing green products for dirty ones. You know, that fundamental logic is still there, where wealth comes from.
It still comes from the ground, and it still comes from nature. And I wonder if it's just a part of being human that we are exploiting nature. How do you counteract that?
Right. We have to use resources. And what I argue at the end of the book is that, you know, I'm not saying we don't take anything from nature, because we do, and we have an interrelationship with nature. There's a term for it, socioecology. It's this idea that social networks and environmental networks do coexist. We've always used nature to support life,
yeah.
Right? So how can we do that without wrecking the place? And we know that it can be done because societies have done it in the past. Current societies are doing it, you know, to varying degrees now. And it's just a matter of looking beyond the role of ourselves as individual consumers and the choices that we make and looking at the larger picture.
So what you're not arguing is that people should stop doing the green things like the reusable bags and the reusable cups and any of that. You're not arguing that. You're saying it just may not be enough.
But there are some, you know, quote unquote, green products that are really bad.
Let's talk about some of those. You talked about a few of them. Some of them include this label of organic food, and sometimes it's a little deceptive.
I would say that locally grown organic food environmentally is very sound. I looked also at globally grown organic. Increasingly, as big corporations take over the organic food industry, they are sourcing organic inputs from all over the world, developing countries primarily. So I ended up in Paraguay on an organic sugar plantation, which supplies a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. This plantation is doing things like clearing trees, clearing native ecosystem to expand its organic cropland. This doesn't make environmental sense. It makes economic sense. And yes, they're not spraying the crops with chemicals, and that's better, but they're pulling apart these vital ecosystems that can't be replaced, at least not anytime soon. Biofuels, for example, the government mandates consumption of biofuels in this country, in Europe, in parts of China, and in many other countries around the globe. It's increasingly popular because it's seen as a green, renewable energy. What's happening in places like Indonesian Borneo, where I went and spent some time in the rainforest and some indigenous villages, is that they are clear-cutting one of the last large remaining rainforests on the planet to grow crops for biofuels. Where I was the last remaining viable habitat for the orangutan.
You actually visited one farm that you considered kind of beyond organic, the Morse Pitts,
mm-hmm.
Windfall Farms in New York, and he was really struggling.
Yeah.
So talk to us about the broader implications of that.
This is the other side of the economics of organic. The small local farmer is hailed as the hero of this wave of environmentalism and the transformation of the food system. And what I found is that so many of these farmers have a really hard time making ends meet, even though they charge quite a bit of money for the produce that they make, but their costs are so high and there's such a dearth of infrastructure for them. The farm bill, $300 billion, the vast majority of that goes to conventional, polluting, scorched earth agriculture. It doesn't go to supporting holistic systems that are community-based and that are local. And if we could start to reorient those priorities, it would make a tremendous difference. And it would make that food much more accessible and much more affordable for regular people.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Heather Rogers. She's written a book called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. These independent, quasi-independent agencies that certify, they also have these huge corporations like Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland on the board. Did you have a sense that that is just compromising their standards?
Corporations were founding members, and it was a partnership that they entered into with the World Wildlife Fund. And there are some other environmental groups that participate. One of the plantations I visited where this plantation company is illegally deforesting, they're making the refining palm oil, which they sell to a company called Wilmar, which is partially owned by Archer Daniels Midland. So you have this dispossession of native indigenous communities absolutely wiping out of this rainforest and burning the trees once they've been cut down. And that kind of forest clearance has made Indonesia the third largest CO2 emitter globally. This is a country without developed industries. It trails only the U.S. and China in its CO2 emissions because of all the deforestation.
You are not somebody who says more regulation is really going to help. You address the socially responsible business kind of approach, that what you even call the triple bottom line. And it sounded like you didn't have a lot of faith in it.
I don't, because I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the economic system. There's a critique in this. It's often referred to as natural capitalism or green capitalism. Natural capitalism says we need the government to come in. So natural capitalism is an interpretation of capitalism that says you can clean up the environment, you can green your business, and all of this will save you money, make your enterprise more efficient, and it will win over customers. And in this economic system, because it does have to grow, that energy goes back into expanding the business and intensifying, you know, making new markets and further intensifying consumption. So it's not like you retire those savings. So when Walmart replaces its truck fleet with more fuel efficient vehicles, it's not like the greenhouse gases that aren't being made are just put away. Walmart opens another store and another store and another store.
Let's talk about ecological housing units that you saw in Europe. You seemed inspired by them.
You know, I look at what's not working, but I also look at what's working. I went to Germany to the town of Freiburg, which is referred to often by people as an eco-village, housing a total of 15,000 people. They've been around for over a dozen years, and so they have this track record. You know, is it comfortable, weird? You know, is it like culturally kind of alienating? And what I found was that it was very accessible, and it's different for different people, of course.
What is it about it that works?
What works is that they've built buildings using passive house methods, which is a super insulated building method and very well-made components that hold as much energy. In Germany, about 3/4 of all CO2 emissions come from heating of the building emissions. So it's really important to have really well-insulated structures. There's also buildings in this neighborhood that actually produce more energy than they use. They all have solar panels as their roofs. And something that the German government is doing is they have this thing which is called the feed-in tariff. How it works is regular people can put solar panels on their house. They plug those solar panels into the grid, and the utility is obliged to buy power from them for 20 years at double the going rate. So that means that individuals can pay off their solar panels in 7 to 8 years, and then they get a dozen years of pure profit. So it becomes financially doable for them, because with renewable energy, all the costs are up front. And with coal, we get to spread those costs out over time. And it's not something that the government is paying for in Germany. All the ratepayers chip in, so everyone's participating. I'm not totally opposed to regulation. I think that everything kind of plays a role, but there has to be ways that we use all the different, you know, mechanisms that we have in ways that make the most sense.
Okay, now let's end with transportation. And one of the things that you're critical of is the carbon offset. First of all, talk about what the carbon offset is and what your considerations are. Where do we go from here?
So carbon offsetting is available to regular consumers. It's a voluntary product that we can buy. When you get an airplane ticket, say, there's often now an option on the website to say, you know, offset my carbon from this flight and pay $10 or $15 extra. And that money goes to a company that then partners with nonprofits, typically on the ground in places most often in developing countries. China and India are the number one sites of carbon offset projects. I went to India, where 1/4 of all the world's offsetting projects are being carried out. And what I found is that, you know, it sounds great. I emitted this carbon. I paid this money. Now my conscience is clear. Except it doesn't quite work like that. Carbon can only be neutralized over time. So if you plant a tree, it's not until the full lifespan of that tree is over that carbon has been absorbed. That might take 100 years. And clearly we need carbon to be reduced now. And then there are other issues with carbon offsetting, like do the projects actually get carried out at all? There can be really unintended consequences. One of the places I went to was a renewable energy plant that was supposed to run on crop wastes. And what was happening is that's in this very poor farming region, and people are cutting down trees to sell to the plant to earn extra money. There's all kinds of possible snags that are really hard to anticipate when you're sitting at your computer and you want to do the right thing. What we need to do, I think, is to really not accept an oversimplification of the situation we're in and why we're here. From what I saw on the ground, carbon offsetting, it can't take carbon out of the atmosphere.
Tell us how we should approach this now.
We need to practice our environmentalism in a range of ways, not just through what we buy. Part of that environmentalism, the way that we can practice it is by educating ourselves. I think if we can expand environmentalism to include the social, we see environmental crisis so in such a compartmentalized way. And I think if we can start to open that up and understand the connections between the social, the economic, and the environmental, we can really start making some progress that is based on hope and not based on false hope.
Thank you, Heather Rogers. The book is called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Thank
Maria,
you so much.
Thank you.
To understand the shore, it is not enough to catalog its life. Understanding comes only when, standing on a beach, we can sense the long rhythms of earth and sea that sculptured its landform and produced the rock and sand of which it is composed. When we can sense with the eye and ear of the mind the surge of life beating always at its shores, blindly, inexorably, pressing for a foothold. To understand the life of the shore, it is not enough to pick up an empty shell and say, this is a murex, or that is an angel wing. True understanding demands intuitive comprehension of the whole life of the creature that once inhabited this empty shell, how it survived amid surf and storms, what were its enemies, how it found food and reproduced its kind. What were its relations to the particular sea world in which it lived?
Ecology scientist and author Rachel Carson from Pacifica Radio Archives Environment Series.
That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.